to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Good evening and welcome to We the People. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Dockery. Gloria Steinem died Wednesday, September 2nd, at her home in New York City. She was 92 years old. And whether you admired her, disagreed with her, or perhaps never gave her very much thought at all, there is no denying that she was one of the most recognizable and influential figures in the American women's movement. I learned of her death through an article in the New York Times, and as I read it, one particular statement stopped me. The article describes Steinem as having been denounced by virtually every conservative leader. Think about how sweeping that statement is. It creates the impression that Gloria Steinem and the cause of women's equality stood on one side, while essentially every conservative leader in America stood on the other. That is a very neat version of history, easily packed up, but it is also not accurate. And I say that not simply as someone looking back at historical documents. I say it as a Republican woman who knows many other Republican and conservative women. My mother is 90 years old. She and many of her friends lived through the very years we are discussing tonight. These are not radical women. They are certainly not progressive activists. Some of them are extremely conservative, but they also understand that securing greater equality and opportunity for women was a good and necessary cause, especially for their daughters. They understood it because they remember what life was like before many of these opportunities existed. Now, conservative women did not agree with Gloria Steinem about everything. Many disagreed with her about abortion, marriage, motherhood, and the traditional family. They disagreed with portions of her political agenda and with some of the tactics used by the feminist movement. But disagreement with Gloria Steinem did not mean opposition to women's equality. That is an important distinction, and it is one that is too often erased by the way our history is now presented. We are given a false choice: either accept the entire progressive feminist agenda or be labeled an enemy of women. I reject that choice. Women's equality does not belong to the Democratic Party. It does not belong to the Republican Party. It does not belong to Gloria Steinem, the New York Times, or any political organization. And it certainly does not require every woman to think exactly the same way. So tonight is not going to be a 45-minute tribute to Gloria Steinem, but it is also not going to be an excuse to tear apart a woman the day after she died. Frankly, I don't think either approach would be particularly honest or interesting. What I want to do instead is use her life and the movement she helped lead to ask a much larger question. What did Gloria Steinem's generation make possible for women like me? And why do so many women today no longer recognize themselves and the movement that generation created? Because both things can be true. We can acknowledge the doors that women like Gloria Steinem helped force open without agreeing with everything she believed. We can appreciate the battles they fought without pretending that every direction feminism later took was necessarily the right one. And we can be grateful for how far women have come while still asking whether the modern feminist movement is now helping to dismantle some of the very protections women spent more than a half a century securing. To understand that, however, we first have to understand the world in which Gloria Steinem came of age. She was born in 1934, at a time when the life expected of an American woman was fairly well defined. Women certainly worked. Women had always worked, particularly poor women, immigrant woman and Black woman who never had the luxury of remaining at home. So I don't want to create some false picture in which every American woman was sitting in a perfectly decorated kitchen waiting for her husband to return with a martini in hand. That was never reality for millions of women. But what was very real was that a woman's identity, her economic security, and even her social respectability were still largely tied to marriage. There were professions women were discouraged from entering, positions they were rarely considered for, and rooms in which they simply were not expected to have a voice. A woman couldn't be intelligent, ambitious, and enormously capable, but she was still expected to arrange those qualities around the needs and ambitions of the men in her life. And many of the limitations women faced were not merely social. They were built into institutions. Employers could openly advertise one category of jobs for men and another for women. Women could be denied credit because of their sex or marital status. Pregnancy could end a woman's career. Sexual harassment existed long before the law even had language to describe it. Women entering professions such as law, medicine, journalism, or politics often did so knowing that they would be the only woman or one of very few in the room. That was the America in which Gloria Steinem began her career. She graduated from Smith College in 1956, spent time in Indiana, and then began working as a freelance journalist. Like many women trying to work in journalism at that time, she discovered that editors were more interested in assigning women stories about fashion, relationships, and celebrities than in asking them to cover politics or public policy. Then, in 1963, she accepted the undercover assignment that first made her famous. She went to work as a Playboy bunny at the Playboy Club in New York and reported on what the women working there actually experienced. That assignment is sometimes reduced to photographs of Gloria Steinem wearing the bunny costume, but that misses the point entirely. She entered a world in which women were being marketed as glamorous and sexually liberated and then reported on the rules, pressures, and working conditions behind that image. It was an early example of something Steinem would continue doing throughout her career, taking an experience society regarded as merely personal and asking whether something larger was happening to women collectively. Interestingly, she did not immediately emerge from the experience calling herself a feminist activist that came later. Steinem said her real turning point occurred in 1969 when she attended an event at which women spoke publicly about having abortions. Abortion remained illegal in most of the country at that time. Steinem herself had undergone an abortion in England when she was 22, but she had rarely spoken about it. Listening to other women tell their stories produced what she later described as a big click. What each woman may have regarded as her own private burden was also part of a much broader political and legal reality. From there, Steinem moved from journalism into organizing. In 1971, she helped establish the National Women's Political Caucus. And I think it is important to say that she did not do this alone. The founders included Shirley Chisholm, the first Black woman elected to Congress, civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer, Betty Friedan, and Bella Abzug. But this was not exclusively a Democratic group. It also included prominent Republican women, such as Jill Rockelhaus, who later headed the White House Office of Women's Programs under President Nixon, and Ellie Peterson, a former vice chair of the Republican National Committee. More than 300 women from across the country participated in the original organizing conference. That is not some minor historical footnote. It directly contradicts the modern suggestion that conservatives universally opposed women's equality while progressives alone carried the cause. Gloria Steinem eventually became the movement's most recognizable face, but she was never the entire movement. It included Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, working class women, professional women, mothers, single women, Black women, white women, and countless women whose names most Americans will never know. Steinman's particular talent was communication. She understood the power of television, magazines, and public appearances. She could take ideas being debated by activists and intellectuals and translate them into language that reached women sitting at home who may never have attended a protest or even called themselves feminists. The ability became especially important with the creation of Ms. Magazine. That magazine first appeared as a special insert in New York Magazine in December 1971. At that time, most publications marketed to women focused largely on finding a husband, keeping a husband, raising children, preparing meals, decorating home, and making oneself more attractive. There is nothing wrong with any of those things. There is nothing lesser about being a wife, raising children, or creating a home. The problem was that women's lives were being discussed as those were the only things women could possibly care about. Ms. treated women as full participants in American political, economic, and intellectual life. It discussed workplace discrimination, domestic violence, sexual harassment, abortion, and the Equal Rights Amendment. It addressed experiences women were having privately, but were often afraid or embarrassed to discuss publicly. And people laughed at it. Some commentators predicted that the magazine would run out of material within 6 months. Instead, its original 300,000 test copies sold out in 8 days. Clearly, women had quite a bit to say. Now, I want to be candid from the beginning of this discussion. There are many positions Gloria Steinem embraced which I disagree, some very strongly. But intellectual honesty requires us to resist rewriting history simply because we disagree with where somewhere eventually landed politically. In the next segment, we're going to go deeper into what her movement caused and what is the effect on today's feminist movement. Tune right back in after this. Welcome back to We the People. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Stockery. Before the break, we discussed Gloria Steinem, the world in which she began her career, and the fact that women's equality was never exclusively a Democratic cause. Republican women were part of that movement, too, even when they disagreed with Steinem about abortion, marriage, motherhood, or any number of other issues. Now, I want to look at what women's movement actually accomplished. Because if we're going to criticize the direction feminism has taken today, and I intend to, we first have to be honest about what it got right. It is easy to look at the opportunities women have today and assume they were inevitable. They were not. They exist because women challenged institutions that had operated the same way for generations. They filed lawsuits, lobbied legislatures, ran for office, and sometimes simply refused to accept the answer they were given. The changes did not happen all at once, and Gloria Steinem certainly did not accomplish them alone. Many of the laws we now associate with the women's movement were passed by Congress, overwhelmingly controlled by men and signed by male presidents from both political parties. But the political pressure created by women made those laws increasingly difficult to ignore. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act. The law prohibited employers from paying men and women differently for substantially equal work performed under similar conditions in the same workplace. It did not eliminate every difference in compensation, and it certainly did not make every workplace fair. But it established an important legal principle. An employer could no longer openly defend paying a woman less simply because she was a woman. 1 year later, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII prohibited employment discrimination based upon race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. That word mattered, sex. Before then, an employer could only openly decide that a particular position was appropriate for a man, but not for a woman. Newspapers routinely separated job advertisements into help wanted, male, and help wanted, female. The men's listings generally offered the better paid professional and management jobs. The women's listings were far more likely to offer clerical, domestic, or service work. Title VII did not immediately end those practices. Laws rarely change behavior overnight, but it gave women a legal basis upon which to challenge them. Then came Title IX in 1972. Most people associate Title IX with athletics, but its language is much broader. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under a federally funded education program. Notice the word used by Congress, sex. Title IX was introduced in the Senate by Democrat Birch Bayh, championed in the House by Congresswoman Patsy Meek, and signed into law by Republican President Richard Nixon. That is what bipartisan progress once looked like. The effect on women's athletics was extraordinary. In the early 1970s, only around 300,000 girls participated in high school sports. Within four decades, that number had climbed to more than 3 million. Girls did not suddenly become athletic after 1972. They did not suddenly discover that they liked competition. The opportunities changed. Schools created teams. Colleges offered athletic scholarships. Girls were finally given coaching, equipment, practice time, and competitive opportunities that had long been available to boys. And once the doors opened, girls walked through them. That is why the current argument over the meaning of Title IX is not some abstract culture world debate. The law became necessary because biological sex affected opportunity. Girls and women needed a protected category because without one, their athletic opportunities were routinely given to boys and men. We will return to that point later in this program. The legal changes continued. In 1974, Congress passed the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. The law prohibited creditors from discriminating against an applicant because of sex or marital status. Think about it. Before that protection, a married woman could encounter a lender who wanted her husband's signature before issuing credit. A single woman could be treated as a temporary financial risk on the assumption that she would eventually marry, become pregnant, or stop working. A divorced or widowed woman could discover that years of household financial history had essentially belonged to her husband on paper. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act did not give women special treatment. It required lenders to evaluate them as individuals. That ability to establish credit in one's own name is fundamental to independence. It affects whether a woman can purchase a home, open a business, leave a dangerous marriage, or begin again after a divorce. In 1978, Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. It made clear that discrimination based upon pregnancy was a form of sex discrimination. That may sound obvious today, but employers had routinely treated pregnancy as a legitimate reason to fire a woman, deny her benefits, or force her out of a job. Once again, the law did not end every injustice. What it changed was the legal answer. An employer can no longer simply say, that is the way things are, and expect the conversation to end there. Women also forced the legal system to confront conduct that had long been dismissed as personal, private, or simply something women were expected to tolerate. Sexual harassment became legally recognized as a form of workplace discrimination. Domestic violence came out from behind closed doors and began to be treated as a matter requiring law enforcement, protective orders, and shelters, not merely a private disagreement between a husband and wife. Laws throughout the country were eventually changed to recognize that marriage did not give a husband an unlimited right to his wife's body. None of these advances meant that every allegation was necessarily true or that due process ceased to matter. They meant that conduct should be evaluated based upon evidence rather than dismissed simply because the person reporting it was a woman. We can also see the effect of these changes in my own profession. In 1970, women represented only about 9% of students enrolled in American law schools. Today, women represent approximately 56%. There was no sudden increase in women's intelligence between 1970 and today. Women did not suddenly become capable of understanding statutes, arguing cases, or sitting on the bench. The ability had always existed. What changed was access and the expectation that women belonged there. I have practiced law for 30 years. I know the work required to earn a law degree, pass the bar examination, build a practice, and establish credibility with clients, attorneys, and judges. No movement took my examinations for me. No law argued my cases, built my firm, or worked the hours I have worked. But I also recognize that I entered law school after women before me had already challenged admissions policies, entered hostile classrooms, and proved that women belonged in the profession. Recognizing what they confronted does not diminish what I accomplished. It puts it in context. This same shift occurred in politics. When the National Women's Political Caucus was founded in 1971, only 15 women served in the United States Congress. Today, approximately 150 women serve in the House and Senate. That is real progress. It is still not equal representation, and the presence of more women certainly doesn't guarantee that I will agree with the policies they support. Believe me, I disagree with quite a few of them. But women no longer appear in Congress as an unusual expectation or exception. Girls now grow up seeing women as governors, senators, judges, cabinet secretaries, and Supreme Court justices. Representation matters even when that woman representing you belongs to the other political party. Not every issue associated with feminism produced the same agreement. Abortion has never had that broad bipartisan consensus that laws prohibiting employment or credit discrimination eventually achieved. A woman can support equal education, equal professional opportunity, and equal treatment under the law while also believing that unborn life deserves legal protection. She can also be a Republican and pro-choice, which I am. Neither position should determine whether a woman is permitted to speak about women's rights. Women are capable of examining individual issues and reaching their own conclusions. That was supposed to be part of our liberation, too. Feminism also sometimes made the mistake of speaking about marriage, motherhood, and homemaking as though women choosing those lives were somehow less liberated. That was wrong. The purpose of opening doors shouldn't have been given to women more meaningful choices, not to replace one rigid expectation with another. A woman should not be told that her only acceptable role is inside the home, but she also should not be told that raising her children, caring for her family, or valuing her marriage represents a failure to fulfill her potential. Freedom has to include both women, despite all the progress, meaningful work remains. Women now make up a majority of law students and law firm associates, but they remain a much smaller percentage of law firm partners. Women have entered every major profession, yet many still struggle to balance demanding careers with the responsibilities that continue to fall disproportionately upon them. Domestic violence, sexual exploitation, maternal health care, and workplace advancement, and the economic vulnerability of women raising children alone remain real women's issues. This is why I find the current direction of organized feminism so frustrating. There is still important work to be done for women. Yet rather than maintaining its focus upon those issues, much of the feminist establishment has embraced an ideology that makes the category of women increasingly difficult to define, and sometimes treats women as intolerant for defending the sex-based protections the movement fought to create. After more than a half a century, we should be protecting those gains, not pretending they no longer require a protected class. The achievements of women's movement were not imaginary. They changed laws, institutions, professions, and the direction of millions of women's lives. We should be grateful for them. But gratitude does not require blind allegiance, and it certainly does not require us to remain silent when a movement created to advance women's rights begins sacrificing those rights to a different political agenda. When we return, we are going to look at where the fractures began. How did a broad movement for women's equality become so closely attached to one political party? When did disagreement become betrayal? And how did a movement based upon the reality of being female arrive at the position that biological sex may no longer determine who is a woman? Stay with me. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. So far tonight, we have looked at the world in which Gloria Steinem began her career and at that extraordinary legal and cultural changes that occurred during the rise of the modern women's movement. Now we have to talk about where that movement began to fracture. And I want to begin with the Equal Rights Amendment because its history tells us something important about how women's equality went from being a largely bipartisan cause to becoming part of a much more rigid political identity. In March of 1972, the United States Senate approved the Equal Rights Amendment by a vote of 84-8. 84-8. You simply do not get a vote like that unless an issue has substantial support from both political parties. The amendment was then sent to the states for ratification. 35 states ultimately approved it, but 38 were required. When the extended deadline expired in 1982, the ERA remained three states short. But listen to what the Republican Party platform said as late as 1976. Women have been denied a just portion of our nation's rights and opportunities. That was not written by Gloria Steinem. It was not taken from Ms. Magazine or the Democratic Party platform. It appeared in the official platform of the Republican Party. That same platform reaffirmed Republican support for the ratification of the ERA and reminded voters that the party had first endorsed an Equal Rights Amendment in 1940. At the same time, the 1976 Republican platform openly acknowledged that abortion was a difficult and divisive issue. It recognized that some Republicans supported the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, some opposed it, and others fell somewhere between those two positions. Imagine that, a political party acknowledging that its members might reach different conclusions about a serious moral and legal question. I mention this because I am a Republican and I am also pro-choice. Apparently, in our current political climate, some people find that combination difficult to process. I do not. Being a Republican does not require me to surrender my independent judgment on abortion or any other issue. And being pro-choice does not require me to accept every position now promoted under the banner of feminism. I can believe that the decision whether to continue a pregnancy belongs to a woman without believing that a male athlete becomes female by declaring a female gender identity. Those are two entirely different questions. One position does not dictate the other. But that kind of independent thinking has become increasingly unwelcome in both political parties and within the organized feminist movement. During the 1970s, opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment grew, led most famously by conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly. She argued that the amendment could eliminate legal distinctions that benefited women, expose women to the military draft, and undermine the traditional family. Women disagreed intensely about those arguments. Some believed Schlafly was protecting women. Others believed she was protecting the very system that limited them. But here is what is often overlooked. The women who opposed the ERA were also politically engaged women. They organized, they spoke publicly, they lobbied legislatures, they built coalitions and influenced the direction of a national political party. In other words, they exercised the very political party and power the women's movement claimed women had been denied. Feminist leaders wanted women to become politically active. The difficulty came when politically active women did not agree with them. By 1980, the Republican platform no longer expressly supported ratification of the ERA. Instead, it acknowledged what it called the legitimate efforts of both those who supported and those who opposed the amendment. The party continued to endorse equal opportunity, enforcement of anti-discrimination laws, access to credit, assistance for women in business, and greater support for working mothers. but the political coalition surrounding feminism was beginning to split. Abortion accelerated that division. Over time, abortion went from being one contested issue within the broader women's movement to becoming within many feminist organizations, a test of whether a woman could be accepted as a feminist at all. Conservative and pro-life women increasingly found themselves treated not merely as women with a different moral position, but as enemies. At the same time, Republican women who supported women's equality no longer felt that organized feminism had a place for them. The result was that feminists gradually became less a description of someone who supported equal rights for women and more an identity associated with one political party and an entire collection of approved positions. That was a loss for women. A movement representing half the population should be capable of containing disagreement. Women do not share one religion, one economic condition, one family structure, or one political philosophy. Why would anyone expect us to share one opinion about every issue? Once a movement begins deciding that only certain women are permitted to speak for women, it stops being a movement for women and starts becoming an ideological club. Feminism's credibility was also damaged when its principles appeared to change depending upon the political identity of the man involved. One of the most obvious examples involved President Bill Clinton. In 1998, while Clinton faced allegations involving several women and his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, Gloria Steinem wrote an opinion piece defending him. She argued, in essence, that an unwanted sexual advance did not necessarily constitute harassment if the man accepted the rejection and did not retaliate. Her shorthand was, "No means no, yes means yes." But Monica Lewinsky was a young 22-year-old White House intern. Bill Clinton was the president of the United States. Whatever one believes about consent between adults, the imbalance of power could hardly have been greater. Years later, after the rise of the hashtag MeToo movement, Steinem acknowledged that she would not write that same piece again because more had become known about other women. I respect the fact that she revisited her position. People should be allowed to reconsider what they once believed. But the episode raised a question that has never entirely gone away. Are feminist principles applied consistently, or do they become negotiable when the man involved is politically useful? If women are expected to believe women, that principle cannot depend on whether the accused man is a Republican or a Democrat. If an abuse of power matters, it has to matter even when the person holding the power supports your political causes. Otherwise, it is not a principle. It is a partisan protection. And that brings us to the most significant transformation of the modern feminist movement, its approach to gender identity. This is where I want to be very clear. Transgender individuals are human beings. They should not be subjected to violence, harassment, or cruelty. They should be able to work, obtain housing, and live their lives without being treated as less worthy of basic human dignity. But treating someone with dignity is not the same thing as eliminating every meaningful distinction between biological males and biological females. Those are not equivalent propositions. Interestingly, Gloria Steinem herself once recognized that distinction. In 1977, she wrote an essay titled, "If She Doesn't Fit, Change the Foot." The title captured the question she was asking. If someone feels unable to fit society's expectations of masculinity or femininity, should the individual's body be changed? Or should society broaden its understanding of how men and women are permitted to live? That was a distinctly feminist question. Early feminism challenged gender stereotypes. It argued that a girl could be tough, athletic, and ambitious without becoming less female. A boy could be gentle, emotional, or uninterested in traditionally masculine activities without becoming less male. The message was that your personality did not have to conform to a stereotype attached to your sex. But decades later, Simon's position changed. In a 2013 essay, she wrote that transgender people were living real, authentic lives, and that those lives should be celebrated, not questioned. She describes society as moving away from the binary categories of masculine and feminine and toward a continuum of identity and expression. People are entitled to change their minds. That is not my objection. The problem is that the broader feminist movement did not stop at protecting transgender individuals from discrimination. It increasingly embraced the proposition that a person's internal gender identity should override biological sex, even within categories and protections created specifically for women. That is an entirely different claim. We moved from saying that a man should be free to express himself in ways society considers feminine to saying that his identification as feminine may actually make him a woman. We moved from challenging stereotypes about women to using those various stereotypes as evidence that someone is a woman. And somewhere during that transition, women were expected to surrender the right to define themselves. I have practiced law for 30 years. I understand that legal rights depend upon definitions. A statute cannot protect a category of people if no one is permitted to identify who belongs within that category. Title IX prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex. Pregnancy discrimination laws exist because female biology has consequences. Women's athletic categories exist because male and female bodies develop differently. Women's prisons, domestic violence shelters, and certain medical protections exist because sex can be directly relevant to safety, privacy, and physical vulnerability. If gender identity always overrides sex, what happens to those protections? That is not a hateful question. It is not an attack on transgender people. It is the unavoidable legal and practical question created when two different claims of rights come into conflict. Yet much of the feminist establishment now treats the mere asking of that question as an act of intolerance. Today, agreement on equal rights is often no longer enough. Women are expected to accept an entire ideological package or risk being pushed out of the movement altogether. When we return our final segment, I want to ask the question at the heart of tonight's program. Who speaks for women now? Can a woman support equal opportunity, reproductive choice, Title IX, and protection from sex discrimination while rejecting modern gender ideology? Can conservative women reclaim a voice in this discussion? And can feminism return to defending women without treating every disagreement as an act of betrayal? Stay with me. I'll tune right back in after this. Tonight, we have looked at the life of Gloria Simon, the movement she helped lead, the doors that movement helped open, and the political and ideological divisions that eventually changed what feminism came to represent. So now we arrive at the question at the center of this entire discussion. Who speaks for women today? And my answer is that no political party, organization, magazine, activist, or public figure has the right to speak for all of us. Women speak for ourselves. That was supposed to be the point. Women fought to be treated as independent human beings capable of exercising our own judgment. We did not fight our way out of one set of restrictions simply to be handed another list of opinions we are required to hold. I am a Republican. I am also pro-choice. I support equal opportunity for women, and I strongly support protecting women's sports. I believe transgender people should be treated with dignity, and I also believe that biological sex is real and sometimes legally important. None of those positions cancels out the others. They represent conclusions I have reached after living my life, practicing law for as long as I have, and examining these issues for myself. I do not need the Republican Party to tell me what I must believe about every issue because I am a Republican. And I do not need the feminist establishment to tell me what I must believe before I'm permitted to care about women. That brings me to another question. Do I consider myself a feminist? Honestly, I'm not sure that the label matters to me anymore. If feminism means that women possess equal human worth, should have equal treatment under the law, and should be free to pursue careers, raise families, own businesses, participate in politics, and speak without asking permission, then absolutely, I believe in those principles. Smack the feminist tag on me. If feminism requires me to support an entire progressive political agenda, vote for one political party, and pretend that biological sex becomes irrelevant whenever it conflicts with gender identity, then no, I do not wear that moniker. But here's the more important point. No one gets to revoke my concern for women simply because I refuse the label, or because I refuse the ideological conditions now attached to it. The word matters far less than the rights themselves. We should not have to choose between returning to a time when women were denied opportunity and accepting a modern ideology that denies the importance of being female. Those are not our only choices. I have no desire to return to the world in which a woman needed her husband's participation to establish credit, pregnancy could openly end her career, and professional schools could treat her application as less valuable because she was female. I also have no intention of pretending that a man's declaration of gender identity makes his body female for every legal and practical purpose. Both positions are entirely consistent. In fact, protecting the gains of the women's movement requires us to recognize the biological reality upon which many of those gains were built. Title IX did not prohibit discrimination based upon personality, clothing, expression, or an internal feeling. It prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex. Women's sports were not created because women preferred different uniforms or identified with different teams. They were created because male puberty produces physical advantages that matter in athletic competition. Pregnancy discrimination laws do not exist because of a social identity. They exist because women become pregnant. Protections for women in prisons, shelters, and intimate settings exist because sex can be directly relevant to safety, dignity, and privacy. Recognizing these realities is not cruel. I am tired of watching the word compassion be used to end every serious discussion. Compassion for transgender people does not require women to pretend there are no physical differences between the sexes. Respecting an adult's freedom to live as he or she chooses does not automatically determine who should compete in women's athletics, enter a woman's prison, or access a shelter created for women who have survived male violence. Those are difficult policy questions. They involve competing interests, and they deserve more than accusations and slogans. Transgender people deserve dignity. Women deserve boundaries. And that includes boundaries within bathrooms as well. A just society should be capable of acknowledging both. What it should not do is tell women that our boundaries are inherently hateful or that our discomfort is merely something we must overcome in service of another group's validation. Women have heard versions of that argument before. For generations, women were told to ignore their instincts, remain polite, and avoid making anyone uncomfortable. We were told to accommodate, remain quiet, and put the feelings of others before our own safety. The women's movement taught us to question that. It told women that our experiences mattered. It told us that we had a right to establish boundaries. It taught women to say no and expect that no to be respected. It is a rather extraordinary reversal that some modern feminists now tell women that establishing certain boundaries is itself an act of discrimination. And while so much attention is being devoted to redefining who qualifies as a woman, the problems affecting actual women have not disappeared. Women are still victims of domestic violence and sexual exploitation. Women raising children alone remain economically vulnerable. Women continue to struggle with pregnancy discrimination, maternal health care, caregiving responsibilities, and advancement into the highest levels of their professions. Girls around the world are still denied education, forced into marriages, and subjected to sexual violence. Here in the United States, women continue fighting for protection from trafficking, abuse, and harassment. There is more than enough work for a women's movement to do. That is why I find its current priorities so frustrating. This is not a movement that completed its original mission and therefore needed to invent a new purpose. Its original mission remains unfinished. Yet women are watching organizations created to protect us devote their political power to dismantling the meaning of the category they were established to represent. What happens to a woman's movement when it cannot clearly tell us what a woman is? Who exactly is it representing? And how can it measure discrimination against women if the category includes anyone who claims it? These are not clever questions. They do have legal consequences. As a lawyer, one thing I know is that words matter and definitions matter. A right that cannot be defined cannot be consistently enforced. That does not mean every legal distinction based upon sex is justified. Many were not, which is precisely why women challenged them. But eliminating unjust discrimination does not require us to pretend that every distinction between male and female is meaningless. Equality does not mean sameness. Men and women are equal in human worth. We are equal before the law. We are equally entitled to participate in public life, pursue our ambitions, and make decisions upon the direction of our lives. But equality does not require us to deny the body. And perhaps this is where the feminist movement needs to return to one of its own original insights. A woman should not have to change herself to fit someone else's expectations. Early feminists rejected the idea that being athletic, ambitious, assertive, or uninterested in motherhood made a woman less female. They argued that society needed broader understanding of what a woman could be. That was liberating. A girl who dislikes dresses is still a girl. A woman who never wants children is still a woman. A woman who stays home to raise 5 children is still a woman. A lesbian is not less of a woman because she is attracted to other women. A female attorney entering a male-dominated courtroom does not become masculine by succeeding there. Women do not need to conform to femininity in order to qualify as female. That principle created freedom without requiring anyone to deny biological reality. We should have expanded it rather than replacing it. Gloria Steinem often used the phrase, "We are linked, not ranked." There is something valuable in that idea. Human beings are linked. We possess equal dignity. None of us should be ranked as more or less human because of our sex, race, religion, or personal identity. But being linked does not mean being identical. It does not mean that every boundary disappears or that every category becomes interchangeable. We can recognize our common humanity without denying the differences that sometimes matters. Perhaps that is how we should consider Steinem's legacy. She was neither a flawless hero nor the villain some people would like to make her. She was a complicated woman who helped change the way America talked about women. She challenged institutions, amplified experiences that had been ignored, and helped millions of women imagine possibilities they had not previously considered available to them. She also took positions with which many of us disagree. Some of her positions changed over time. Some deserve criticism. That is how honest history works. We do not have to canonize Gloria Steinem in order to acknowledge her contribution. We do not have to embrace every direction feminism took in order to appreciate the women who fought for equality. And we do not have to surrender our own judgment in order to prove that we are grateful. In fact, The greatest acknowledgement of what those women accomplished may be exercising the independence they demanded for us. Gloria Steinem spent her life encouraging women to find their voices. This is mine. I am a woman. I believe in equal opportunity. I believe in marriage and family. I also believe in the choice to not marry. I believe women should be free to build careers, businesses, and lives of their own choosing. And I believe women have the right to retain our name, our boundaries, our athletic categories, and the legal protections created because we are female. Women are not a voting bloc to be owned by either party. We are not a collection of approved opinions, and we are not a category that can be expanded until the word itself has no meaning. We are women. The movement that bears our name should not ask us to erase ourselves in order to prove how inclusive we are. It should protect our freedom to speak, disagree, and stand our ground, even when the people demanding our silence call themselves feminists. That is Gloria Steinem's complicated legacy. It is also the unfinished work she leaves behind. Thank you for joining me tonight. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and this is We the People.